Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your super laminated insider's guide to all the best of film, TV, music and more. I'm Andrew Harrison. This week, Mad About the Roy. On today's show, we go full beast as perhaps the best programme on TV, HBO and Sky Atlantic Succession returns to our screens. Will Jesse Armstrong's series about media mogul Logan Roy, his brassish offspring and associated theme park controversies hit the right note? And Past Caring or Future Perfect, the 15th studio album from Duran Duran, Future Past, is released on the 22nd of October, that's next Friday. It features collaborations with Graham Coxon, Errol Alkan, Ivorian Doll and a certain Giorgio Moroder. Have Duran Duran managed to sail their massive yacht into the current cultural tide? Plus, dream a little dream. Claudio Loza's evocative horror movie Fever Dream is streaming on Netflix right now. Set in Argentina, we see the mothers of two children meet during a seemingly idyllic holiday, and things become very disorientating, to say the least. Would we recommend? All this and more in today's Bunker.
Welcome one and all. I'm Sian Pattenden and you just heard Andrew. With us in the studio today is Alex Andreo.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, both. I'm glad to hear that all was well on my week off.
We just about held it together.
Yeah, I can imagine it was terrible. We missed you quite a lot,
I'm sure you didn't. Let's waste no more time and introduce our special guest today. Clark Collis is the senior features writer for Entertainment Weekly in the US of A. In the distant past, he was the co-founder of Neon Film Magazine. He worked tirelessly for that old rag Select magazine, and he's just released You've Got Red on You, How Shaun of the Dead Was Brought to Life. Hi, Clark. Welcome back to the Culture
Bunker. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I should say, appropriately, given that Shaun of the Dead is about slow-moving zombies, that the publication has actually been pushed to mid-November because the boat on which the books are being transported from China hit COVID-related travel issues.
Is it stuck in the Suez Canal with the Evergreen?
Pretty much, but I think the books have now reached the UK. But the important thing, as always, is that you can pre-order You've Got Red on You by Clark Collis.
By Clark Collis.
Very much so.
Available for pre-order.
Thank you.
It is a detailed look, as we know, Shaun of the Dead, from its very inception to its legacy now. What exactly made this movie chime with an audience? What was its USP?
Well, it's interesting because it is it's a zombie movie and it's a comedy, but it's also really captures like what it was like to live in London, circa 2000. Mm-hmm. And circa 2021, arguably. Whenever I watch it, I almost forget that it's a zombie film, which is sort of part of the point of the movie, because its central thesis is that living in London or any big city is pretty much like living during the zombie apocalypse anyway. But whenever I see, there's a couple of famous long shots where Simon Pegg gets up hungover, his character is hungover, and walks to the shop and back. And the joke is that the second time he hasn't noticed that the zombies have taken over. But I mean, that was my Sunday, and it's recognized, even though I lived in South London and this is North London, it's recognizably like that. I certainly don't want to say a walk of shame, but a walk of hurt when you would get up on a Sunday morning not feeling that great and think, oh, well, a newspaper and a can of pop might help me out. And so you take that, or maybe an ice cream, maybe a Cornetto. So you take that walk and come back. And it's so much about living in London, circa 2003, 2004. Mm-hmm. And obviously that is not going to resonate. In one way, that isn't going to resonate with people around the world. But I think Simon Pegg always says that if you can make things specific enough, then actually those will chime with people everywhere. And I think that's very true about Shaun of the Dead. Plus zombies and a couple of Queen songs. So,
Yes. Do you think the film opened up the door for more horror in this country, at least? Would we have had that collective tour de force of directors that we have now, like Ben Wheatley, Alice Lowe, Peter Strickland, if there wasn't this film and if Pegg and Wright hadn't moved forward with it?
I think to some degree. Because they all, all of those names, really, it's interesting because you think of them as horror people to a degree, but they also come from the comedy scene. Alice Lowe particularly. Certainly, Shaun proved that you could turn a pound on a horror movie, which hadn't really been the case in Britain during the 80s and 90s. What is interesting is that they coined this comedy rom-zom-com, this term rom-zom-com, romantic zombie comedy, as, you know, obviously it does describe the film, but also as a bit of a tongue-in-cheek joke. But if there was, you know, if we still had video stores, then you could go into a video store and there would be now a whole shelf of romantic zombie comedies from you know, Zombieland onwards. Yeah. So it's certainly been inspirational, you know, in that way. And the cast themselves, I mean, you know, Peg and Frost. I mean, Nick Frost was, you know, had been working as a waiter, I think, 2 years prior to appearing in Shaun of the Dead, working title of production company. I mean, the one big problem they had was casting Nick Frost in that film originally. But I mean, Edgar and Simon and Nick have all gone on to, I certainly don't want to say better things necessarily, but certainly bigger things.
Mm. What are your favorite insights from the book?
Insights. Yes.
What can you promise the reader, Clark?
There is a lot of. I mean, I thought it was going to be, in all honesty, I thought it was going to be a jolly book about some people having a lot of fun making a movie. And to some degree, that's true. But very early on, Edgar Wright said to me that one of the reasons that people think that they had a great time making the movie. But certainly from his point of view, he did not have a great time making that movie. Yeah. And was keen to sort of point out that nobody wanted to give them the money, that, you know, from him. I mean, I think he would say that he puts himself through hell on all of his movies, but particularly, you know, on that film. You know, he'd made that film in his head. I mean, he wrote it with Simon, but from a visual point of view, he'd made that film in his head, but found it very, very hard to get across to people what he wanted. There is a section in the film called The Plan, and it's that part that's very memed, especially during COVID, has been very memed, where Simon Pegg, you know, goes through all the different things they could do to try to survive, we're going to wind up in our flat, and the flat's windows are broken, so you can't go there. But it's a very, from a visual point of view, it's lots of cuts and takes and shots and shot at different, you know, moments during the shoot. And Naira Park, the producer, who's really the sort of, I mean, you'd call her the fifth Beatle, but really she's the fourth Beatle, said that every time they tried to get money, the first thing that everybody wanted to cut was The Plan, because just one point of view, it doesn't really add anything to the plot, particularly, or just describing what's going to happen. And of course, you know, 16 years on, that's one of the bits that everybody remembers. It lives on in the internet.
Yeah. Now, you've just been back to New York for the first time in God knows how long for Comic-Con.
Yes.
Where I believe you interviewed your close personal showbiz friend, Jamie Lee Curtis. How was that then?
It was good. It was good. I didn't meet her at Comic-Con exactly, but Jamie Lee's just a force. I mean, I've interviewed her quite a few times, and she has this, I mean, she's in Halloween Kills now. She is a force of nature. I remember interviewing Dave Lee Roth once. And I asked 30 questions, and he gave me 30 entertaining answers, none of which were remotely connected to the questions that I'd asked. Right. And so I then had to go back, probably shouldn't be saying this, but I then had to go back and work out the questions that would fit the answers that he gave.
Lee Scratch Perry do this to you as well?
Very similarly, yes.
And his answer, you know, what is the rationale behind your life? And he said, terrible magic from Jupiter.
And that's about the size of it. Although I can tell you that there's no question really which the answer, terrible magic from Jupiter, fits. But no, Jamie's great. She is absolutely a force of nature. And my mission was to ask her to talk about four things that scared her. And at one point in the interview, she spent like 10 minutes talking about the things which didn't scare her, which is all of which is very entertaining, but was in this particular moment, for this particular rubric, was literally the opposite of what I wanted. But you just can't stop her. And I find this is absolutely unique amongst celebrities, but she turns up early to things and calls you early. So if she says she's going to call at 3, you've sort of got to block off the previous 2 hours in case she takes it upon herself. And we did a cover shoot with her for the last Halloween movie, and she turned up an hour and a half early. And I happened to be outside when she drove herself up. And I was like, you're an hour and a half early. And she said, I like to scare people. I like to keep people on their toes. And I'm like, oh, fair enough. And she did. There was pandemonium when she arrived at the studio, as you might imagine.
Before we move on, do remember you can get The Culture Bunker and all of our shows early and without adverts when you support us on Patreon. That's The Culture Bunker at the weekend, our weekly politics panel show on Tuesdays or Monday if you're a Patreon backer, and shorter Bunker Dailies throughout the week. There's a really good one about Bond knocking around at the moment for Culture Bunker types. You'll also get smart merchandise and extras too.
Succession is one of those shows that, like The Sopranos, pulls off a real magic trick. It gets you to care about a group of genuinely unpleasant people. More than that, to luxuriate in their awfulness. The series charts the internal battles of the Roy siblings, who make the Borgias look like the Waltons, as they tear strips out of each other in order to position themselves as heir to monstrous patriarch Logan Roy, played by Brian Cox, and gain control of media giant Waystar Royco, which is definitely, definitely, definitely not based on a real company or family. It is Aaron Sorkin meets Aaron Spelling. It is Euripides channeling Falcon Crest, and it is back after a 2-year isolation for a third season. Having ambushed his father by exposing the company's serial Me Too cover-ups, the wonderfully damaged Kendall Roy, played by Jeremy Strong, is now in exile, high on his act of rebellion and desperately in need of allies. Here's a little amuse-gueule.
I dropped a bomb. The whole world is watching for my next move.
You're the number one trending topic ahead of Tater Tots, and the Pope followed you.
Wow.
Okay, no, this is not the... Is this the real...
I don't think this
is a Pope.
My family have disappeared. I need to know where everyone is and what everyone's thinking.
There he is, the little man who started this big war.
Right now, I'm the real you.
Sure, and I'm the real you. You sound deranged.
As I understand it, you want to take down your dad without implicating yourself.
Correct.
And without damaging the company to the extent that you lose control at your shareholder meeting.
Do you have an actual case, Ken?
Yes, I can kill him.
Is he going to watch?
Could we make a note in the minutes that he's watching us?
There's blood in the water. Sharks are coming.
We're going to lose the company. We're going to lose the fucking company today.
Investigation's looking pretty bad.
I'm focused on not going to jail.
Logan says we have to take these cyanide pills. It's a mint, you doofus.
Sean, there is a sort of terror when a new season drops of something you really love, isn't there? An unspoken acceptance that it's going to be just rubbish because this is, after all, 2021 and everything is rubbish. Was it?
No. I was so delighted when I got access to some of these episodes. I could not contain my excitement. I had a glass of wine and then another glass of wine as I watched it, as you know, and I have now watched them twice because the wine was running. Yes, so I've watched up to six. I also, as I know a few people did, watched seasons 1 and 2 over the summer just to sort of get in the mood of it. And the fantastic, obviously, the end of the last season 2 where Kendall does drop the bomb and puts his father in it. But also we see... We may see the father has a certain delight that the fight is on. And in the trailer is obviously they're going to go full beast. He is up for the challenge. He's up for the fight, Logan Roy. So to see this and to see the characters, there is a nervousness that it's not going to be very good. But once you're in, you're in. It's not a show that you can watch while putting the kettle on or eating.
It requires full commitment.
And especially the first couple, because there is so much going on. And with each and every character is so rounded.
Yeah, yeah.
They're so three-dimensional. Their motivations are not only very real, but they change even within one episode as to what they want and what sort of power they're after getting it and who they're going to get to, that you really, really have to concentrate. But my, this is... I mean, Shakespearean is... I mean, it makes Shakespeare look like a, you know...
Like a guy wrote old plays a long time ago.
I like the fact that Jesse Armstrong wanted it to be a cross between Dallas and Feston. And that, to me, makes something really, really exciting.
Yeah. Clark, when something that is arguably the best show on TV right now ends the season with arguably the biggest cliffhanger imaginable, it really gives itself a high hurdle to clear. And with the break being forced even wider because of COVID, did it clear it for you? Did that anticipation?
Yeah, I think, yes. I loved it. I watched the first 7 episodes. And by the way, if you've just seen the first 6, Sean, strap yourself in.
Okay, I've got 7 for tonight.
I won't say anything, but oh my God, it is absolutely good. Amazing. I absolutely loved it. I watched the first 7 episodes. And then, I mean, one of my rewatches, which I did a couple of times during the pandemic, was The Thick of It.
Okay.
And which, I mean, Jesse Armstrong worked on The Thick of It, I'm thinking.
So, yeah.
And, you know, it has a lot of similarities, but there does come a point rewatching the thick of it when you're like, when you can feel the poison, you know, leaving the TV and emptying your veins. And after watching 7 episodes of this, I did think, I'm glad I now have a break before I can watch some more. And that's kind of, you know, that's a credit to the show that it does sort of exude such malevolence, really. But no, I thought it was fantastic. And also, I mean, it was a huge bombshell. But what's interesting about the show is someone who reports on it and interviews people about it is that, you know, they're very no spoilers. We're not going to tell you anything about the show whatsoever. But in fact, it is full of incident. But actually, if you think about it, the chess pieces have not moved that much in like two seasons. And really, it's weird because, yes, you want to know what happens. But kind of what happens, quote unquote, is the least of it, really.
Yeah.
Because what you really want is these people being vitriolic.
It's how it happens. And it's like that. The vast entertainment of it is just watching the way these brilliantly drawn characters both kind of show who they are, but also who they're desperately trying to be. And a kind of recurring thing I noticed was the characters are always asking other characters, am I reacting right to this? Am I saying the thing I ought to say?
They've constant validation.
But also constant construction of their fake exterior. They've spent such... Because it's essentially the story of an abusive relationship, of an appalling patriarch who's warped his kids to the point at which nobody's real anymore. Nobody knows who they are anymore. And they're constantly...
King Lear.
It is a little bit King Lear. Glad you said the old word there, Sean. So his kids, his progeny, no longer know how to be people. They only know how to be pieces on the chessboard.
Yeah.
I was looking at the this is not a spoiler in any way at all, but looking at the posters that tease the show, you see effectively the Roy clan split into two. But in each poster, you see people have actually changed sides multiple times. So who's loyal to whom?
Yeah, it's very smart, actually.
Are people even loyal to themselves?
Andrew, one of the things that sets it apart for me is that it's not one of those serious shows that reaches for designer glum.
Yeah.
It really is laugh out loud funny.
It's incredibly funny.
At many, many. Did this season keep that up? Dark humour.
I think so, yeah. I mean, obviously, Roman, as the kind of Loki of this particular bunch of, you know, plutocratic Avengers, never fails to deliver hilarity and bleakness and horror, but also with his, and this is not a spoiler at all, because the Roman and Jerry thing that developed at the end of last season, like, what's going on here? What sort of validation are you looking for here with Jerry, who's noticeably older than you, Roman, and much more of a serious individual than you? What the is going on there? That's remarkable. But the Tom and Cousin Greg aspect, which was for a long time the kind
that
of engine
was the
of comedy,
duo, wasn't
is
it,
now
was
becoming it? A little bit more. Yeah. It's a lot darker.
Yes.
It starts to get weirder. And I think the Jerry and Roman stuff is starting
getting
to get
very, very weird.
Is starting to get really quite perverse.
So I was kind of, you know, at the back of my mind, I had this sort of thought that maybe Succession is the story of Greg.
Maybe we're Greg. Well, I think we're Roman as well, though.
I thought it was Greg from The Off, actually. Just because he's our eyes and ears in this. He's the everyman.
He's the pillar
looking around, at this.
Is he also
world.
Not the first person we see in the show?
I think he's
working at the amusement park.
And he's inside the giant Mickey Mouse style head being sick.
Which is definitely not Mickey Mouse.
Yes.
Sean, there's also quite a lot of political satire hovering in the background like an orange spectre. The president is referred to as the raisin.
He's
talked about as an inconveniently independent contractor.
Yes.
Is that aspect of the show plausible? Do you think to yourself, oh my God, that is actually what goes on? Or does it suckle at the teat of conspiracy a little bit?
Oh, what a question, Alex, suckling at teats of conspiracy. I think that you suspend your disbelief in this because this is a show where people have meetings and the meeting's only four people in the room. And it's the family, and and they get to the matter, and then they decide what to do within about 2 minutes. It isn't real life; it isn't something that happens. But there's a very interesting thing about the Roy family's influence on the president. Again, no spoilers, and about what happens, and there's something, an inciting incident that happens that blows a bit of things apart.
I think it's not necessarily a spoiler to say that We know that Waystar Royko's output is essentially Fox News.
Yes.
And at a certain point, one of the key characters says, we can square a lot of these things off by offering contributor contracts.
Yeah.
Now, we know that Fox News keeps senators and commentators on the payroll to say certain things. Mm. That's drawn from life. I don't think that's a spoiler. Mm. I think that's kind of, this is where you see, that, again, well, as Clark was saying, that's not about plot. That's about, this is the world that you enter. This is the world as it operates.
Yeah.
Clark, I'm going to disagree for the sake of argument with Andrew and say that if you strip away the power and privilege aspect of it, if you basically take away its grandness of scale, does the show have actually things to say which are universal to families and timeless to human nature? Is that the secret to its success, that these battles go on a minute scale, on a microaggression scale, in every family?
I think that's true. I was thinking about this particularly, I mean, they're not related, but with Tom and Greg, and what like a spin-off show would look like if they were if they were like running a B&B.
Oh my God.
In like, I don't know, like Vermont or wherever. And I think that would work, and yet the opulence of the setting does give it, does supercharge it,
and the way that they talk about the general public, the way they deal with the controversy of the cruise ships, they don't care about the victim. There isn't nothing that touches them that isn't in the family and isn't in their world of being on a yacht rather than on a cruise ship.
But I think the cleverness of it is that it's able to do both of those things at the same time. It absolutely is about a dysfunctional family, and that dysfunctional family could be running a B&B, or it could be, you know, very regular jobs. And it's also about the way that extreme wealth warps a person. It's about how being abstracted from society leaves you in this rarefied place where you don't know who you are anymore.
There's that remarkable scene where Shiv is doing a press conference and some music comes on in the background that someone has put in as a comment, and she just doesn't understand. It's that these people really are not touched by real life, and they're not touched by the pain of other people. And that is incredible, and it's just so beautifully done.
And the way in which Kendall insists on doing rich white guy hip hop slang to be Kennedy. Who's in the house,
it's
like, Jesus, please stop doing that.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
There's a point where he walks up the steps. Now, this is someone of immense privilege, the white guy. He said fuck off to his dad, walks up the steps of some big dude, and he just says, fuck the patriarchy at the press.
Mm.
And his messiah complex is never interesting.
Before he does that, he turns to his current girlfriend and says, shall I do a thing? Shall I provide some content for the press? Mm. Shall I effectively put on a coat that says, I really don't care to you?
That's what he's doing.
So that's where it's really, really acute and clever.
I find myself sympathising a lot less with the Greg character. And Matthew McFadden's Tom seems to me to have graduated from sort of spineless twit to full-blown arse.
Mm.
Is there anyone left in the show that you can root for?
I'm a huge fan of Carolina, but that's just me. I think she's great. More Carolina, please.
I wonder why.
Yes, just file some deep positions.
I will say it is a very low bar, but I find oddly the Alan Ruck, I find myself shipping, I guess is the term, Alan Ruck and Willa. Alan Ruck's character, rather, Connor and Willa. You're like, I wouldn't say that's a... It's still a pretty dysfunctional relationship for many reasons.
many.
But I'm kind of like, they do seem to like each other.
She hates him. Can you not see the look on her face every time he squeaks at her?
She hates everything.
You saying that does make me alter my view of my previous relationships. So I'm going to have to go back and maybe she hated me. I
like Jerry, but I wouldn't want to work with Jerry in real life.
I wouldn't want to work with that. I quite like the utterly obnoxious Roman.
I love Roman.
I like him because he's kind of got a chaos instinct that he can't control. And the way he has squared it off in his head is to say it's all a game and none of it matters.
But it's interesting that as he gets nearer the top of the pecking order, the pressure coming from Logan seems to push him into a more cogent person.
Yeah, almost. Yeah.
I have to mention the music by Nicholas Britell, which for me is one of the stars of the show. That riff that keeps repeating itself.
It's the greatest TV theme not written and produced by Delia Derbyshire there's ever been.
The way it comes into different moments at different tempos, and sometimes it's this sort of big Baroque symphony and sometimes it's a sad little pianola, I think He's part beautiful. Of the show.
Absolutely. One
genius.
Thing I always loved about it, and always forgot to say on this show, because we do talk about this programme sometimes, is that the credits are in alphabetical order.
Right.
And as soon as I saw that at the beginning, I thought, I like this programme.
Oh, that's...
Because that, to me, is an ensemble piece.
Well, while we're talking about things like that, the ever slightly evolving title sequence,
yes.
which is a mixture of faked old family footage and contemporary footage. But the thing, I hadn't realised this in three seasons, whenever we see Logan, he's walking away from his family. He's in the distance. His back
yes.
is turned.
Yeah,
and the whole family dynamic is, when will this titanic figure ever pay attention to us and show us some love? And the answer is only when he wants something from you.
And I must say that that title sequence owes a big debt of gratitude to The Game.
Right.
Yes, I watched The Game recently and saw the similarities.
Big debt
yes,
of gratitude
you're absolutely
to
right.
The Game.
Yes.
I find Cox's transformation most startling this season, Logan Roy, because I had watched season one and two in the first, you know, before to prepare myself, I find myself comparing him to that doddery old man in the first episode that ends up pissing in the corridor because he can't find the bathroom and has a stroke, et cetera, et cetera. And I wonder, first of all, whether it's the conflict that revitalizes him, whether actually he needed this fight to quicken him. If they hadn't given him resistance, he'd have probably just died off.
But, this develops. So hold that because there's something about the way that he plays people. And
but also whether it's a win-win situation for him. He has bred this litter of ruthless gladiators. Mm. And if one of them managed to vanquish all the others and beat him, then they deserve the business. Mm. Oh. So his downfall is his glory in many ways. Do you see what I mean? If he has managed to breed another version of himself, he has succeeded.
Which is
that's
why,
the only thing that can take him down.
Which is why what we start to see in season three is, much as Logan rages against Kendall, he now has respect for him. Mm. The story of season two was the destruction of Kendall, wasn't it? It was Kendall being reduced to nothing.
Yes.
And in that final scene where he stands up and tells the truth. Mm. I'm not kidding. I was standing in front of the television screaming and punching the air. It was like the 2005 European Champions League final. I was like, get the fuck in. Yeah. This is brilliant.
The Olympic ceremony.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was incredible. So what we have seen is that sort of trans... That, you know, it is Kendall's journey in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, I think. One thing I really do want to say about this, everybody talks about in terms of novelistic television of the moment, how does it fit in with great novels of the past? Well, The Great Gatsby was written with was put together with the tools that were available, which were the novel. This is the Gatsby of now, because the tools that are available now are this kind of super rich, fantastically crafted television. Mm. This is what the Fitzgeralds of today are doing. I swear to God, this show will be looked at in 100 years' time the way we look at The Great Gatsby now. It's that good.
So there you have it. Succession Season 3 starts in the wee hours of Monday morning on Sky Atlantic, simulcast with the East Coast HBO premiere. We love it. You will too. It's the law. Just bloody watch it.
Hi, I'm Katie Riley. On the slow newscast from Tortoise, Donald Trump became the first former U.S. president in history to face a criminal trial.
The defendant repeatedly made false statements on New York business records.
This is not a trial. This is not an act of criminality.
We cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct.
This is the story of his first week in court, told through the transcripts. Listen now to the Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts.
Right, let's have some music. Duran Duran's 15th album, Future Past, is 12 new tracks. It also features appearances from longtime David Bowie pianist Mike Garson, Tove Lo, Ivorian Doll and Leaky Lee. Many tracks are also co-written by Blur's Graham Coxon, would you believe? Super DJ Errol Alkan and Mark Ronson, plus Mr. Disco himself, Giorgio Moroder. We'd play a track, but the man is giving us licensing problems, so hop over to our rolling playlist on Spotify and you can listen to a selected tune. Meanwhile, panel, shall we get stuck in?
Mm-hmm.
Clark, I'll start with you, as you once supported Duran Duran in another life.
I did.
As a drummer in a band. Did you like this album, Clark?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it almost seems weird to be sitting down listening to a whole album from beginning to end, you know, these days. It seems sort of delightfully quaint and nostalgic. I did quite like it. I mean, it's very much them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's called Future Past because, you know, they're nodding to their... I should point out, I interviewed the delightfully louche Nick Rhodes earlier this year, and he was saying that the title obviously refers to them looking at their past and also projecting to the future. And you're like, I don't know quite how much projecting of the future there is, really. or if there is, it's almost like the future that they imagined it would be in the 80s or the 90s. But no, I thought this was great. I mean, the tracks with Marauder are great. As you said, you know, Graham Coxon is on it. It staggers me that it's their 15th album, I have to say. I mean, obviously they've been going for a long time, but you're like, wow, that's a lot of music.
30-odd years.
Yeah, no, I guess.
It's actually knocking 40. I don't think that's a very good work rate, actually. Get your fingers out, Duran Duran.
True. I mean, my history with Duran, I mean, I was talking to Sean about this earlier, that I went to school with Simon Le Bon's cousin, which is why I played in a band that ended up supporting them.
Yes.
But I remember him turning up with the Rio album and just everybody being very excited about that and the fact that we knew somebody who would have related to Simon Le Bon. But by the time of the next album, I think I'd got into like heavy metal and was listening to a lot of Gillan and Saxon and real music. And a lot of music I now realize in retrospect that was simply not as good as Duran Duran. and I think, you know, you find, I mean, Notorious is obviously great. Ordinary World is great. And I always think that if Nile Rodgers, for all the sort of galumphing element of Duran Duran, if Nile Rodgers thinks they're funky, then who am I to disagree, frankly? This is recognizably Duran Duran. Does it have a Notorious on it? I'm not entirely sure. But I have to say, every time, it's one of those things that the first time you listen to it, you think, oh, the title track's good and this track is good. And I was listening to it yesterday for like, you know, the seventh or eighth time. And two-thirds of the tracks, I was like, well, this is pretty decent, you know. How many of those tracks will they be playing when they go on tour or will survive to the following tour? I don't know. But
will you be putting a bit of Rouge on and, you know, a blues on?
I personally will not. They do put on a show, though, I have to say. I've seen Duran Duran several times, and I saw them during the Warren Cocorillo years. Warren Cocorillo from Missing Persons joined the band, and he was one for very long guitar solos. And so they would do, like, my memory is, like, 15-minute versions of Hungry Like the Wolf. And but no, it's a proper show. So there are certainly worth shows to see.
Andrew, Graham Coxon is all over the first half of this before Marauder comes in, really. And the second track, I think Invisible is like Notorious, to be honest. That's the first track. But the second track, All of You, sounds like a Duran Duran song. But then I think we get these sort of Graham lyrics coming in. There's a bit that goes, so much more to this song's meaning, I don't have time to say. That's massively Blur. Massively Graham. Did you like this, Andrew?
Well, I've been a long time Duran skeptic, right?
I
could, you know, the very early Durani. The very early stuff was quite good. A Duran denier. And yeah, it was deeply skeptical of their huge kind of stadium, you know, Wild Boys multi-billion-dollar video kind of thing. Because it was the 80s and I was trying to bring down Thatcher with real music, John. You know, when real music that means things. This is a really great record. It's a really, really great record. Enormously enjoyable. I don't think it goes down to the, you know, I think it would be a cop-out to say, well, Graham Coxon's fixed them. I don't think he has. I think what they've done here is they've realised what they're really about, which is, you look at all the people that they inspired, people like Soul Wax, who are really, really amazing. It's like, well, why don't we just try and sound the best of ourselves? The opening track, Invisible, to me, sounds like Cameo in the late 80s when Duran were trying to do their serious funk period, and that is what gave us Notorious. Yeah. But there are huge chunks of it that, you know, Beautiful Lights really does sound like Careless Memories through the Pet Shop Boys filter, but with huge marauderization. In many respects, it is the best version of that kind of song that they've done. Going through the dressing up box and bringing out Mike Garson for the things that got them going in the first place is very, very appropriate, but it doesn't feel tokenistic at all when he does his Time Falls Wanking to the Floor opening piano solo. It feels very much part of the Duran universe. So I was hugely persuaded by this and actually felt a little bit guilty about not liking them in the past because it's a proper, really good, all the medals, exciting pop album. Salty Simon's voice is not perhaps the wonderful instrument that it could be.
Oh,
but I don't know.
I disagree.
Compared with other singers of his age, that voice is incredible. And he does do his shouty thing, which annoyed me on the first track. And I thought, but that's what he does. He hollers.
Yeah.
He just caterwauls into his songs. But that's what we know them for. And that's what the actual Duranis will be really liking. Alex, what did you think about this? As we're saying, it's kind
I'm
of...
I'm not sure caterwaul is a word a singer likes to hear.
Well, actually,
of themselves.
Not listen,
that's the punk rock dimension. They always wanted to be Chic, but Chic meets the Sex Pistols, didn't they? Well, that's the Sex Pistols half of it, yeah.
So we have 70s here. We have their 80s period. We have 90s, through them also embracing things like Errol Alkan and Graham Coxon. What did you think?
Well, look,
it's all music forever.
So I am a fan, unlike Andrea. I was never a Noran. I mean, because I grew up with Duran Duran. Mm. They were the big band of my teen years. And there was also this weird thing that happened abroad where we got smacked with two Duran Duran albums at once. Their first album didn't really make a splash in Europe or America, for that matter. I think the same thing happened in America. So when their second album, when the single started doing well, suddenly we also got Rio and,
Hungry Like a Wolf
and Say a Prayer. Mm-hmm. And so we got hit with the best of two albums, single after single. Mm-hmm. For a while, and that made them absolutely massive. And it was also the time when MTV started going. And in Greece, there was this thing, which I guess was quite progressive at the time. So what happened was the national broadcaster received all these satellite channels via a big satellite dish and then retransmitted them all on normal channel frequencies.
Mm. So the national Greek broadcaster was pirating international content.
Basically, yeah. Which,
go on,
you've
Greece.
Been to Greece a few times. Does this
it's
surprise you?
Very broad attitude to these things.
So, suddenly you had all these channels out there and MTV got going and their videos were
amazing.
What do you
think of this album? That's the past, Alex. What's about this one? Is this bringing it all back?
What I was going to say is that I love it because I think they are a band that were not credited enough when they first came with not being manufactured, with having their own sound. Everyone considered them quite plastic pop, but I think over the years they've proved that wrong because they've stayed faithful to that sound.
Yeah.
There is a definitive Duran Duran sound that you recognize from the first bar.
Yeah.
I think More Joy is a really beautiful dance track.
Yeah.
And I like anything Giorgio Moroder. I mean, you know, he Donna Summer disco tracks and the soundtrack to Midnight Express and American Gigolo. He's basically woven into the gay fabric of my gayness. I am Pavlovian completely programmed as soon as they hear those beats. It just makes me happy.
It's Duranicky.
Don't Duranic.
Are we in a situation, Andrew, where this is a world where Duran Duran are now really great guys? Like Rick Astley is now obviously a really great guy, and the people like Ian Brown and Morrissey have let us down, and we're now in pure pop has come to save us.
Let us down mildly. Yeah. Well, I mean, pop always wins. Pop is always better than here are my thoughts on the world, and which is why I've looked back at the person I was in the 80s with the proper music that was going to bring down Thatcher and think you are an idiot, you fool. Because actually, this is much more the music I like right now. It is exciting. It is life affirming. It is a better version of Duran Duran than we've seen in a long time. Because they have, let's be honest, let's be objective, they have made some fairly rotten records.
They have been
time.
Lazy in the past, haven't they?
And well, they haven't concentrated on being themselves. And the standing joke that is their covers album is one of the blots on the copybook, shall we say. This is really great. And I'm not sufficiently well researched in this to be able to make the statement it might be the best Duran Duran album, but I don't think it's out of the running of that.
Absolutely, I would agree. I mean, I think even since the Wedding album, this is incredible. I thought that there's so much that say they're so comfortable being themselves, but they've gone into something else. They're actually, one of the songs being called More Joy that you mentioned, they're actually joyful about being themselves. Mm. They're not embarrassed anymore because it was a big embarrassment shame stuff because they were knobheads on the yacht. We can all say that.
Well, when in the great glory old days when they were taking Polaroid photographs of detuned television.
Well, I like
calling
those bits. Those are the bits I like.
That's the fun stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But here it's just like, we're Duran Duran.
Hello. And I absolutely love this. I think the collaborations are also my favourites because it's when they get Les Chirani and Simon doesn't holler quite so much. So I'm absolutely, totally surprised I've been dancing to this all week.
Who'd have thought it?
Who would have thought it?
So I was wrong.
And we were right.
So we're saying Duran Duran is centrist music. Is that what we're saying, basically?
I do not know about that.
I wouldn't go that far. Now, we always ask our guests to bring in a tune, their editor's recommendation, as it were. And this week is no different, although we are running up against the man and his refusal to allow us to play things actually on the podcast. Yeah. So we're going to put this onto the Rolling Spotify playlist, which you can find in the show notes. There's a link at the very top. Clark Collis, which tune are you recommending for the listeners this time?
Yes, I'm recommending Loan Your Loneliness, a recent single by Griff Rees. From the Super Furry Animals.
Is this because you're basically pushing Welsh things?
Yes, actually it is. And you know, yes, it is. Because as you can tell by my accent, I'm born and bred Welsh.
Deeply Welsh.
I was bred Welsh. But I went on holiday. What I find is all my stories really involve me going on holiday because when I'm at home, I'm not doing anything. So you've kind of almost got to do a year load of years worth of experience when you're on holiday. But I went on holiday to Malta, which was delightful. Mm-hmm. And myself and my girlfriend, we noticed there was a cinema. And we thought, well, we'll go and see what – I like seeing what going to the cinema is like in other countries. It turns out – that going to see a film in Malta is like going to see a film in which a Welsh village combines to raise a horse and win the Welsh Grand National. So we saw this movie, Dream Horse.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I saw that.
Starring Tony Collette.
Famously Welsh Tony Collette from Australia.
They raise a horse, it wins the Grand National. Sorry, that is a spoiler. but the wonderful thing is, this is not a movie I would ever have watched, but I loved it. It's a sports movie, Tear My Eye, Welsh Village. But all the music is like the Mannix and the Super Furry Animals and Catatonia and, you know, all this great sort of modern-ish
Gorky's
pop
on
music.
It.
I think Gorky's are on it, actually. And then that sort of encouraged me to check out for the first time in a while Gruff Rees's, I always want to say Gruff Rees Jones, but Gruff Rees's new album, which obviously, as you can imagine, it's very predictable as a concept album about a volcano positioned between the Korean and Chinese border. Yep. It's just terrific. It's very much him. You wouldn't mistake it for anybody else. It is varied. And it's just an incredibly sort of warm-sounding, you know, humanist album. I loved it.
If only we could play it on the podcast. Go to the Spotify list, people, and have a listen.
Fever Dream is a wonderfully hallucinogenic return for Peruvian director Claudia Llosa. It follows affluent urbanite Amanda, played by Maria Valverde, who arrives in a rural area for a summer holiday with her little girl, Nina. She's befriended by troubled neighbour Carola, the stunning Dolores Fonsi, who confides in her that she's worried her own child, David, has not been the same since the sudden illness forced her to take him to the local witch doctor. Soon things take a turn for the strange. Here is a little tapa to whet your appetite.
It's all in Spanish, of course, but we're here for the vibes.
Mi madre siempre lo decía. Tarde o temprano algo malo va a suceder. Cuando pase, quiero tenerte cerca.
Sí, está sucediendo, Amanda.
¿Esa es vuestra casa?
Buenos días. Carola, bienvenida.
No siempre tocan en dos vecinos.
Tú tampoco eres de acá, ¿no?
Nací acá.
Me gustó desde que la vi.
Si te cuento, no vas a querer verme más.
Clark, this is essentially a regression whodunit, in that it's told from the point of view of a feverish character on the deathbed, trying to relive the memories of the last few days in as much detail as possible to try and understand who or what killed them. This means a non-linear narrative. Did it skate the right side of confusing for you?
I think so. I mean, there was certainly 2 minutes at the start when I thought, what the hell's going on? But I find in my average day there's usually 18 hours where I'm wondering that. No, I didn't find it confusing. Yes, it starts with the sort of lead female character being dragged through a forest. I mean, you just sort of see her face. You're not really sure who's dragging her or what's going on. And then it flashes back to sort of the beginning of her extended stay in the country with her daughter. The voiceover is by her and this other child and this boy, and they have a conversation and you learn. Yes, it is a voiceover, but it's also clearly them in the present talking about the past.
Yeah.
And you're seeing the past. I thought it was wonderful. I thought it was just absolutely terrific. I thought the performances were great. I thought the air of horror was great. You're in and out in like 85 minutes, which is amazing. There is this sort of genre of horror, which is basically a woman cracking up for reasons which may be real or maybe all inside her head. Rosemary's Baby, obviously, is an example of this, although at the end of that you do find out what's going on.
Spoilers, Clark.
Well, I didn't say which way it went. It could be anything. And this year there's actually been quite a few movies like this. Censor was like that. There's a film which hasn't come out yet but was at the Toronto Film Festival called A Banquet, which is absolutely terrific. Saint Maud is similar. I mean, I don't mean to say these films are similar vibes, but they're all about a woman at their center cracking up. And obviously, as I said, there is a long, long history of this kind of movie. What's interesting with all of these movies, the four I've mentioned, including this one, are all directed by women, which, and I'm not saying, oh, well, they're going to have a different point of view and blah, blah, blah. But if you're going to have films about women cracking up, then eventually it's maybe not a bad thing to have those films made by women, it seems to me. And certainly, I mean, I didn't love all the films, but I'm certainly glad I saw them. And I was very impressed by this. I thought it was terrific. I will say, and maybe, I don't know, maybe this is the wrong thing. I wish there was some word for films which horror fans will enjoy but are not necessarily horror movies.
Yes. No,
because if you say something is a horror film, I think a lot of people will be like, oh, there's going to be a masked killer will then be disappointed when this doesn't show up. Where's Having said which, you don't want to put off people seeing films like this. Yeah. But you want to, I wish there was a word which sort of, and people used to talk about elevated horror, and that was a term that everybody decided was a terrible snobbish.
Does that take
term,
place in a lift?
Yes. It's all.
That would be great. I'd watch that. Train to Busan.
I'm not a fan of reading up on the background of a film, or in this case, the book that inspired it, Distancia de Rescate by Samantha Schweblin. But on this occasion, the film is so ambiguous, you actually found it helped get a little bit of background.
To get a bit of background about the book, about the similarities between that. Also, I wanted to know a bit more about the director, who has previously directed a film based on, I believe, a short story about a woman who puts a potato in her vagina. Just wanted to say that because that's the kind of film I watch.
Vagina potato, yeah.
So not as good as Vagina Potato 2.
But what I felt was that the people I was reading about were more interesting than the film itself. The film I found really, really difficult and I couldn't get to the end of it. I think partly because it is about the fear of your child becoming independent. It's about this very peculiar bond between the two women, which I really loved, because a lot of horror is a woman on her own, as those films that Clark said. Some of them are about a singular person experiencing something bad. Mm. These are about two women experiencing something similar, but in these very, very different ways. And it's completely disorientating. But because it's about childhood and about closeness and about parenthood and those things, I actually found it such a difficult subject matter for me. And maybe it was just the day that I was watching I couldn't get to the end because I was too worried about the children.
Which is why I mentioned the Spanish title, which is Rescue Distance.
So it's the distance that you would allow yourself.
So much better.
If you were within the proximity of your child before you think the child may be in trouble, if they're just a little bit too far away that you can't run to save them.
And the film visualises that cord that links a mother to the child. Yeah. There's a sort of bungee rope.
Yes.
That the further you go from your child, the more you feel it pull,
yes,
the more you feel the pressure that you are leaving a child alone.
Yes, so good about the film is that is what it's giving you, and that absolute fear and what you have for your child that doesn't really go away as a parent. It, you know, even when they grow up, it doesn't really go away. I found it, you know, that bit so well done that I found it really, really hard to watch towards the end, and I didn't want bad things to happen, and I believe bad things may happen.
Oh. Andrew, the ending is deliberately unexplained. Have we come to rely too much on some voiceover tying everything up with a neat bow? Is this basically Latin American magical realism butting heads with Hollywood convention?
Well, my main thought about it was, if you're looking for the Spanish language picnic at Black Rock, then this is the one for you.
Yeah.
Because the horror is in the confusion. The horror is also connected to our experience of watching movies, because the horror is the confusion that you don't really know what kind of a film you're watching. Am I watching a horror film? Am I watching a psychological horror film? When is the guy with the knife going to turn up?
Yeah.
When is the explanation going to arrive? And the horror is that the explanation is not going to arrive. You get this kind of inkling early on that this is not going to conform to what you expect from a drama, from a horror film. Also, without giving too much away, there is a strong strain of counter-rational magic to it, and also a strong strain of something very real and concrete connected to our material world that is explicable to us, that's caused all this. Which is it to be? Are we in the realm of, as you say, the magic? Are we in the realm of concrete causes and effects? Has it combined that into some kind of cinematic version of magic realism? I don't know. I found it very haunting. I think it looks beautiful. I think there were the performances that stick in your head. It is a film which you will walk away from and worry about rather than as much as one.
I agree. The film sat with me for a while after I watched it and got better after I watched it.
The two leads are so good. Yeah. They really are so good.
I mean, the two lead women are exceptional, but the boy that plays David, Emilio Vodanovic, is also really quite a haunting presence. The film is effectively a long dream sequence, and so it's packed with sort of disorienting non sequiturs and symbolism, which really create an oppressive atmosphere. There's this shapeless horror, but only, I found, if you surrender to the film, if you stop trying to rationalize, if you stop trying to translate poetry into prose, it works.
I have to
the
stop.
Moment you start to think of it as Pet Sematary, it ceases to work.
The nature of the flashback movie is often that the thing you think is insignificant is actually a key turning point to the film. And I had to turn off that part of my brain after a while, because I realised that we weren't being shown a trail of breadcrumbs and clues here to a neatly tied up denouement. We're being shown a sequence of shards of memory, impressions.
The majority of which are red herrings.
Majority of which are red herrings. So, yeah, it's I can't say I thought it was it's not a massively satisfying film, but the point of the film is not to satisfy you. This film is supposed to disorientate you and fascinate you.
Clark, one final very quick question. This is being released on Netflix and at the same time on limited release on cinemas. What do you think of that, this vague of releasing things on streaming and at the same time on limited release? I mean, will anyone go to the cinema to watch this? They should, because it's visually stunning.
No,
but will they?
I definitely wish I'd seen, I mean, I really did enjoy it, but I certainly wish I'd seen it at the cinema. What I will say is, I know people are vaguely aware that things can get lost on Netflix, but as somebody who will receive emails about shows that were it not for the email, I simply would, Netflix shows that were it not for the email I was sent, I would simply not know that it existed. Like, it is hard to overstress how much things can get lost on Netflix. For all of the Squid Games, where it's like the world seems to have, as one, discovered something, that it is true that the world can, as one, not discover something. And so anything that sort of, helps publicize a movie like this has to be helpful.
One point I want to make about this, music by show favourite Natalie Holt, who did the music for Loki. She's the woman who chucked a bucket of water over Simon Cowell at the X Factor. Show
We've
hero.
Her before.
Yes, show hero, Natalie Holt did the music, which is really good music as well.
Yes, it's great.
So there you go. Yeah.
Fever Dream is an unlimited cinema release from this week and also streaming on Netflix.
Now, we don't often pick our own tracks on the show, do we, Sian? We don't have the time or the space, but this week is different. We're going to choose some tunes to chuck onto the Spotify playlist.
We certainly are.
What are you going to throw on there?
I'm going to throw on the playlist Wet Dream by Wet Leg, which I can't stop playing. Wet Leg, as you may know, are two tiny children, almost very young and very amazing and full of potential girls, Rhianne Teasdale and Hester Chambers. They are from the Isle of Wight. I have never heard anything like it, and yet I have. There's some element of the Breeders to Wet Leg. There's some element of Kim Deal having a laugh with another Kim Deal, not caring what anyone thinks. And this is just a joyful, stupid, and also quite rude song, which is a complete indie banger. And as I say, I absolutely love them. I'm desperate to see them live, and they are playing in November. I want the album now. I was one of those bands where I really, really need to hear 10 more tracks of this stuff. Absolutely fantastic, so I recommend them. What's your track?
You're putting Wet Dream by Wet Leg on. Yeah. I have chosen Sleaford Mods remix by Orbital.
I've listened to that this week.
Yes, it's like that, almost a record designed and built for me.
Yeah.
Orbital Hartnells have remixed I Don't Rate You by the Sleaford Mods. And it takes the Sleaford Mods trademark rantiness into the headspace of the early 90s rave.
Yeah, yeah.
What
it
could
works
be better?
So well, doesn't it?
It really does. So they're both on our Spotify playlist. Yeah. Click the link and you can have a listen right now. And with that, it's the end of the show and closing time chatter. What will we be talking about as we get caught in the long grass and a dislocated voice of Spookchild murmurs something about worms in our ear? Don't drink the water, kids. Clark, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, to go back to my very nice holiday, one of the books I read on holiday was by Stephen Graham Jones, who's a Native American horror writer and is one of the gentlemen who is hailed as the new Stephen King, although I have to say Stephen King, doesn't seem in any rush to stop being the current Stephen King as it is. But he wrote this book called The Only Dead Indians, which is great, but it's too good, really. I was reading it, and two-thirds of the way through, I was like, this is the most disturbing book I've ever read in my entire life. And so that's sort of a recommendation if you're into that kind of thing. But I was staying at one of those places where they have like a library of books, and it's like, well, you can take one of these if you leave a book, right? Which always, for some reason, that kind of warms me. But the only book I had was this incredibly disturbing horror novel. And in the end, I just threw it away rather than leave it in the library because I didn't want, I would only recommend this to horror fans. And I guess it's a question, like, am I being overly sensitive here, or is that like a reasonable thing to have done? I mean, I hate throwing away books, but I could have brought it home, admittedly.
You don't like to leave books that might freak people out.
Mm. Well, yeah, but this was like, there was a point where my girlfriend was like, well, if it's disturbing you this much, stop reading it. You know, and I'm like, no, I'm going to plug on.
So if you next year, when you will have your own book,
yes,
and it's not stuck in a port somewhere, will you basically just take a box of it and replace all the books in the library with
yours? No, what? No, I will leave.
Just force people
I will leave cards inviting people to pre-order my book. Buy my book. No, I'll not be giving away copies of my book. Thank you very much.
Buy it with money. Alex, what's your closing time chatter?
So, Fire Shut Up in My Bones opened at the Metropolitan Opera in New York and will be broadcast live to both online and to selected cinemas on Saturday, October the 23rd. It's by Terence Blanchard, and it's a real moment of history. It's the first Black composer to stage an opera at the Met in its 140-year history. Progress has been slow, to say the least, but it's a wonderful thing because this is an art form that's considered very, very white privilege.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the Metropolitan Opera, its first production of Porgy and Bess was in 1985, 50 years fully from its Broadway debut, because they didn't have the Black artists on contract to fulfill the Gershwin requirement that the cast should be Black. And so progress has been slow, but it is happening. I have heard snippets of it. It's wonderful. And the brilliant thing about it is that the predominantly Black cast all entails established Metropolitan Opera singers now.
Right.
Because there are a lot of wonderful singers of African-American origin on their books. Mm-hmm. So October 23rd in cinemas and online, mm-hmm. a real moment of history, I think.
Wow. Sean, how about you?
Banksy.
Okay.
Yeah. He's been at it again. You know the shredded artwork, Girl with the Balloon?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that got shredded, but now it's been resold.
Oh, they sold the bits?
They've sold the bits, and he's renamed it Love is in the Bin.
And the bits have sold for $16 million.
Absolutely. So it proves that you just need to make art about how art is a bit shit and about the art world's a bit shit, because that's what Grayson Perry
so
does.
If you fed the Mona Lisa into a shredder, it would become more valuable.
Yes, absolutely.
Has the person who's bought this signed a contract that they weren't trying to stick it back together with tape on the back?
I don't know. I mean, what do you do? Do you stick it back together with tape? Do you just hang it on the wall as it is? Do you re-shred it and then sell it for $23 million? What did it get Banksy round to then say, oh, I hate this artwork in a video? And then, I mean, you know, it's so sort of anti-art, we're anti-everything. It all sort of gets cloistered together. It's like a car that then gets sort of compacted. It's quite sort of bitter and hateful. And I would just think, oh, my goodness me.
I just had this image of vision of one of the Roy family buying it and Cousin Greg being tasked with gluing it all back together.
I think Cousin Greg would just go, like, I found the documents you shredded, so I burned them for you.
Exactly, or spilled coffee on it, as Cousin Greg would do. Yeah, but it's another thing of why I will never, ever understand the popularity of Banksy.
There you go. Well, my closing time chatter.
What is it?
I was rather sad that Christchurch in New Zealand has made its official wizard redundant. This guy, Ian Brackenbury Channel, aged 88, was being paid £8,200 a year to provide acts of wizardry and promote the city. And they've just let him go. They've given him his P45. Right, he's told local media that he no longer fitted the vibes of the city because he's a provocateur. These are a bunch of bureaucrats of no imagination. And I was thinking, come on, Christchurch. Mm. Nothing good ever happens when you sack the wizard. Have you not ever
watched enough films?
Absolutely. Yeah. Don't watch it. Have you not read any fairy tales? Have you not? But then Clark has given me a new angle on this, which is perhaps not quite as
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, this is sort of one of those end of the news item stories, but I'm afraid there is a slightly serious note that it turns out that basically what seems to have happened was that the wizard was Me Too'd, and he appeared on... or opened himself up for Me Tooing and appeared on some TV show. In an April screening of Channel 3's comedy current affairs show New Zealand Today, hosted by Guy Williams, the wizard said he liked to tease women by telling them they were devious and said they use cunning to get men who are thick. And then a lot of other stuff that I don't really feel like reading. Right.
So basically,
so we need to cancel the wizard.
Where are we in a society when we can't even trust our wizards anymore?
So, look, have you not seen The Wizard of Oz? That's the gist of it.
Not really
right?
a wizard. Actually, a guy in a box. Not really a wizard.
Yeah, get it now.
Anyway, well, I think on this case, none shall pass in this case, particularly not a redundant wizard.
Absolutely. Well, that's the end of the podcast. Thank you so much to Clark Collis for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been genuine pleasure.
Just it's been generally a pleasure.
Generally okay.
Mostly, partially a pleasure.
You've got Red All on You. Will be in bookshops in November.
That's
you can pre-order it. It's still on a boat somewhere. Thanks for listening. From me, Andrew Alex, and producers Alex Rees and Yelena Sofronievich, we'll see you next week.
And it's Sean's birthday. The union of the cake is on the rise.
Thanks for mentioning.
Happy birthday, Sean.
Thank you.
The Culture Bunker was presented by Sean Pattenden with Alex Andreev. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Yelena Sofronievich. And audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.